Okay, this is the session called Poetry and Prayer and Invitation, and my name is Kathleen Mullen. And because I have to do that, I've just kind of messed up what I had intended to be the real beginning of this session. And, well, two beginnings, actually. The first is something I haven't seen anybody else do, so we might as well try it. Because the session is called Poetry and Prayer, I'd like us to start with a prayer. Your prayer, your own prayer, in whatever words you use to whomever you pray to. And I'll do the same. Well, I notice everybody closes eyes. That's an interesting thing. Okay, the second way that I think it would be appropriate to begin this session is for you to turn to somebody whom you don't know, who's sitting around you, and say your name. And say your name so that you can, so that you really hear what that name is. Okay, now I wonder whether you realize that we've all been involved in a poetic act in just these past few minutes. Are you aware of the fact that you were doing poetry in those last few minutes? What were you doing?
Saying a name.
You were saying a name. You were naming. You were saying your own name. And what else were you doing?
Communicating.
You were communicating. What else were you doing besides saying your name?
Listening.
I hope so. I hope you were listening to somebody else's name as well. And that makes it a going back and forth, some kind of communicating. A word that's very rich and which I'm sure will pop up in a lot of our conversations and a lot of the conversations that you'll have in the other sessions. Maybe it's not fair to do this, but I know since I've been here Saturday, I got here Saturday, never been to Holden before, which accounts for my major butterflies at the moment, and my voice does shake when I get nervous, but maybe it goes away. I've heard a lot of people's names, and sometimes people have had to say their names to me twice, as you have, and I haven't remembered those names. So it was a kind of a communication that didn't exactly work. So I would like for us, to say the name of the person who introduced himself or herself to you. Anybody want to start? Anybody remember that? Yeah.
This is Karen. K-A-R-R-E-N.
Thank you.
And this is Cindy.
K-Y-N-D-E. Okay. Karen and Cindy.
This is Jack. This is Eric.
Jack and Eric. Are you looking? Are you looking? I do this with my freshman classes at my school. And we do it every day until everybody knows everybody's name in the class. So we've got Cindy and Karen and Jack and Eric. And?
I remember her name was Naomi, because that's what I wanted to name my little girl, but my husband wouldn't let me.
Naomi, hello. Welcome. Anybody else?
This is Ethel. This is Dorothy.
Ethel and Dorothy. All right, here
this
we
is
go.
Becky back here.
That's Becky,
John,
and
here.
That's John.
Nobody knows him.
Okay.
I went up to meet Naomi because I knew Mary and I knew Becky, so I got it easy.
You have, okay, you have Naomi. Okay, and who else?
This is Connie.
Connie.
This is Nancy.
Nancy.
Nancy works with the miners.
Oh.
In Holden Village. And this is Sherry.
Very energetic
first
job.
Day we were here.
Cherie.
Cheryl.
Okay.
This is Anna Marie.
Anna Marie.
This is Linda.
And Linda.
This is Ellen.
Ellen. And
this is Doug.
And Doug. Okay. Well, we've got it. Can anybody say everybody's name? That's too much on at once.
One new person over here.
And one new person. Hello. My name's Kathleen.
Hi. I'm Luann.
Hi, Luann. Well, naming. Once I wrote a poem that, which I didn't really think about this And I'm probably not going to remember the lines of the poem, but the poem was for a person whose name was Ray J. Shea. The only person I ever knew who rhymed all three names. And I tried to make it a kind of, I should have brought it, I tried to make it a kind of a puzzle poem so that you could kind of guess. I looked for things that were analogous to Ray or sounded like Ray or whatever, and I did J and Shay. And then the last two lines of the poem, it was a sonnet. It's a form I don't work in very often, but it's a very good discipline and exercise. Said something like naming, and I'm not going to remember it, a game, a play, an art, which you have to look at with a heart or something like that. Anyway, that's what we've been doing, is naming. Anybody else sit in on Jan Larson's session this morning, besides Doug and me? Anybody else was there? We talked about naming this morning, didn't she? And the act of, I've just learned to call him Adam, the earth creature, who was naming the animals. God gave the animals to him to name. Jan said it might have been some kind of test. Who knows whether Adam would know the names of the animals. Or it might have been really the main way of understanding the surroundings that you find yourself in by naming. Her word for it was to give domination over the animals. I guess I don't hear it like that. I don't think that because I know your name, I somehow possess a power over you, a magical or a domination over you in any way. I think I see naming as a way of inviting somebody into an understanding of that other person or that other event or that other thing or whatever it is that we are trying to name. I really do believe that both naming and invitation are the essential kind of poetic acts that that people can perform, perhaps knew how to perform early on when they were children, and then in the press of other kinds of worldly things that get crunched down on us sometimes, have forgotten. So I'd like to invite us to learn better in these sessions the arts of naming and the arts of invitation. I didn't know John was going to be at the session because I've cribbed some from the session that I went to from him the other day. He had a diagram on the board which began with word and then went to world. Over here we have solitude, and down here we have community. I don't spell too well, so forget it. he had something in the middle, which I'm not going to copy right now. Maybe that's a step down the road. But I thought how appropriate this diagram and this kind of collocation of words was for the kind of thing that I was interested in doing and in sharing with you. Anybody want to second guess me? Anybody want to jump right in and say why it would be appropriate for me to borrow John's diagram of word, world, solitude, and community in a session on poetry and prayer?
Nancy.
Okay. Well, you were swatting, but I read body language too. So be careful what you do.
Thinking about my own poetry writing, oftentimes the feelings I'm having or reacting come from solitude, and that I always write when I'm alone. But I'm reacting to the world or to my community.
And those come out in very different ways.
And they're two different things, actually. Mm-hmm. And then through the word.
So your kind of way this diagram moves for you, your dynamic for this diagram would begin in solitude.
Yeah.
And then say, sometimes in my solitude, I react to the world, I react to my community, and I try to find words for that.
And also, once the poem is written, there's real power in the written word.
In the word itself.
And once that's written down, I claim it in a different way than when it's in my head. Mm-hmm. And so that's how I see the word reacting to the other things as well, once it's written.
Okay, but to get it there has to come from your solitude. That's okay, interesting. Anybody else want to try to put these together in a different dynamic of configuration?
You could begin with the word in that I'm not the poet, because I'm not really one who writes the poem, but I'm the one who reads the poem and encounters the poem. Mm-hmm. And from that word or that poem, I moved in many different directions depending on that moment. I can be moved in the direction of wanting solitude. Mm-hmm.
So yours kind of...
I can want world or community.
Oh, that's very interesting. So this is kind of after the poet has given you a word. That word, it's a nice way to say it, moves you in many different directions. Well, I think for each of us, there is a different set of connections among these things. Mine begins with the world, I think. For me, not so much with community. The things out there in the world are what invite me to solitude, so that I can figure out how to word them, how to name them, and through that naming come to some better understanding of them. And I guess I feel that is what I can give to the community. So for me, the world calls me to deeper understanding, which I can express to myself in solitude, in my words, and then give that to the community. Maybe that's another way of saying a particular kind of ministry. I'm not sure. I'm trying to find that out. Maybe it's a way of saying this is one of my ways of praying as well. The words at the center of John's diagram were gentle justice, the theme for the summer at Holden Village. I guess I'm not ready to see that yet as the center of this diagram for myself. And I'm borrowing again from another gift of words we've had while we've been here. That's from Elmer's sermon on Sunday night. He was talking about answers and presence. There is no answer, Jesus says to us, and I'm it. And what we learn from Jesus is his presence. What we experience is his presence. So I'd like to kind of make a little bit of a complication here and say that at the center of this diagram for me is that holy presence, both of which kind of punning things on holy is very important for me. Wholeness, holiness, all of the health. These words, as I was reading in Malin Lingle's Walking on Water, which, by the way, is in our bookstore, along with some good things in poetry and in reflections on faith and art. She gives the origin of that word as the old word hail, as in hail and hearty. So it kind of all comes from this sense of haleness. Our holiness, our wholeness, both come from a sense of rightness, of health with ourselves, with our world, in our solitude, with our words, and in our community as well. Now, I was trying to think to myself the other day, well, maybe I should back up a little bit and say partly why I think I'm not, why I'm a little bit nervous about this kind of obsession is that I don't understand myself as a social activist person. I'm not sure if I'm a feminist. I get so many mixed and confusing signals about that from different people whom I hear speaking. I'm only recently come to trying to understand something about oppression and oppressed peoples in the world. So I'm not at all sure that I kind of fit the pattern of some of the other things that you'll be hearing and sharing on the rest of the time. But I did sit down last night and try to begin to understand for myself how I think this session does connect with the gentle justice theme for the summer. My head is stuffed with quotations of good stuff that other people have said. One of them comes from William Carlos Williams, who says, "You will not find the news in poetry, but people have died for lack of knowing what is there." I don't remember where I read it, I don't remember where he said it, but it was something that struck me right away, something very right, and something that I could understand and I could begin to live through. So you will not find the news in these sessions. But perhaps there are people who are dying because they don't know what is in these sessions. Some of the ways that it connects with gentle justice. If we read poems, we have to be open to metaphors. Poets don't say things directly. Some they say them indirectly. They say them through metaphors. They say them through analogies and likenesses. I think perhaps that can help us be more sensitive to, more open to, alternative ways of looking at things, alternative ways of understanding things, alternative ways of acting on situations which we find needing healing in the world. So poets with their metaphors can suggest to us different ways of belonging and doing what we can do in the world. I think that the ways that we use language shape the way that we see the world. If you only know one word for snow, you'd make a terrible Eskimo. Even a terrible Midwesterner, as I've learned, having come up from the swampland to the Midwest and learning that there are many different ways of saying snow. The words we know, the language we open ourselves to, influences the ways that we see the world. Our language also shapes the way we feel confident to insert ourselves into the world, the ways that we can be with other people. This is going to sound like a terrible example, and I haven't really planned to say it, but I guess I will anyway. I was just thinking before this session what some words that have disappeared from my language and my vocabulary in the last several days since I've been here at the village. My family is a wonderful family, and I love them, but they do use dirty language sometimes. And my house abounds in dams and hells and other assorted things. I thought today I have not heard any of those words since I've been here in the village. I hear people going around singing, you know, but I don't hear anybody saying, "Oh, damn it." That's a small example, but it is a way of saying how language influences the way we insert ourselves into the world. It also influences the way we can shape the world, what we can say, to whom. Those people whose names we know, those people whose names we don't know, those people with whom we want to establish communication. How do we do that? No? As somebody was talking in one of the sessions the other day, how do you talk to, how do you preach to a congregation which has so many different people in it. The thing that made me most nervous about coming to these sessions was, how do I talk to a group of people who are so heterogeneous? Gosh, you know? So how we can establish communication. We have to be more sensitive, I think, to what kinds of language really invites somebody to listen to what we have to say. Is it language that really grows out of our solitude? Is it language that's really shaped toward our community? Is it language that, in a bad sense of the world, has too much of the world in it? Or maybe is it language that doesn't have enough of the world in it? Our language and our sensitivity to that, I think, does help bring about justice in the world through the way we can shape it and communicate. And finally, I guess this goes back to the metaphor, sensitivity to language helps us to imagine different ways that the world might be. It's not all down there in black and white and even living color. We have to imagine a world before we can act in that world or act to make the world, help the world become what it can be. The other day, I was reading, a collection called The Earth Speaks, which is in the bookstore and also in the library. And I would recommend that the library's got a great section on poetry, good collections, good people in there. My book was The Earth Speaks, and the gentleman sitting next to me was reading To Change the World. And all of a sudden I thought, oh gosh, you know, what am I doing here? But I believe that if I can't listen to the earth speaking, there's no way in the world I'm going to change the world. So anyway, I think poetry's a dynamic thing. Poetry has a great number a great amount of potential. And I think it's very true that people have died because they don't know what is in poetry, what is in the poet's way of perceiving and opening him, herself, to the world. I have to borrow again, John. John said, let's not have any more Bible studies. Let's have instead living word encounters that aim at transformation. That's exactly what I hope that we'll be doing in this session as well. I don't know whether I think Robert Frost is the Bible. I don't think Robert Frost is the Bible. But I do think that some of the poems that Robert Frost writes are living words. And the things that I've brought for us to read and to study and to think about and to respond to together are all things that have intrigued me with their dynamic and creative potential for my life. I have to respond to those things. They are living. They are growing. And that's what I would hope that we could share. Some living word encounters that will transform us. I don't know into what. I don't know from what. I don't know where we are. I don't know. I know Doug writes. I know Nancy writes because you've mentioned that you do. I don't know how many other writers we have among us. Is there anybody else who would confess to having written some poems? A poem, you know, is language that doesn't go all the way to the right-hand margin. So anybody can do a poem. But that's another thing I hope that we'll take a look at. The title of the sessions are Poetry and Prayer. And that's sheer hunch. I believe that poetry and prayer have something to do with one another. I believe right now that the more we understand how poetry works, the better we can understand how prayer works. I think that there are some common attitudes that the poet and the prayer have and share. But that's what I hope that we'll be able to understand together, because I don't know enough about prayer to sit up here and say this is what prayer is. Imagine each of the prayers that we spoke in our solitude at the beginning of this session. I know that no two of them was alike, or as it were, English teachers forget sometimes. I know they weren't, but I know that their common richness and our common understanding of prayer can be enriched by each of us as we try to get to the heart of it, get to the holy presence of it, get to the place where meaning and understanding are for us now and here. It won't be the same next week, next year. It wasn't the same 10 years ago before I knew Holden Village existed. Maybe it won't be the same at the end of the session. But to get to the heart of it, that's what I'm hoping that our time together will help happen. Any questions or comments or extensions or?
What are the common elements that you see, or maybe that's what you mean?
That's what I'm not going to start with at all. I guess maybe the only thing that I've started with, the common thing of poetry and prayer, I think I know a lot, but it's still not ready to be spoken. It's that wonderful word, inchoate. You know, it's not quite there yet. I think there's a lot that's on intuition. The one that I begin with is attention. I think that both poetry and prayer require as intense an attention as we can manage. And I like that word, attention. It's got a lot of words in it. I did a minor in Latin in college, so a lot of what I know about words comes from what the Romans said. This literally means ad tendo, to stretch toward. And I think that's what the poet does with the world or with the community. And I think that's what the person who tries to pray has to do also, to stretch toward. But then again, it's a two-way street, because sometimes it's the world that invites me to write about it. I don't always invite, you know, I don't always say, oh, there's that twig, I'm going to stretch toward it and write about it. Sometimes the thing reaches out and grabs you. And it stretches toward you. So it goes back and forth. Anybody else? I don't wear a watch, so I have no idea what time it is. Anybody?
It's 4:30.
It's 4:30, so we have some good time yet, right? We have until 5 o'clock? Will somebody say when it's 5 till 5? I had a student in class who, to try to get me angry one day, set his watch, tick-tick, you know? And I said, oh, thank God somebody's got one of those. And so now they do it for me all the time, 5 minutes before the class is over. Okay, I have brought some poems, which I think are poems of invitation. I'll have to ask for these back. I didn't know how many folks were going to come. But how about if I can put one copy of everything that we do in the library, so if you want to take a look at it a little bit later. Also, I brought some, I'll tell you about that later. Okay, here's some poems by whoever wrote the Song of Songs, Robert Frost, and somebody whose name I don't know. How's that for the introduction? Yeah. I'd like to start with, there are 14 folks?
Mm-hmm. Would you mind telling us a little bit about yourself?
Oh, sure. I'd be glad to do that. Why do I come here? How did I hear about Holden? I've never been here before. I teach at Valparaiso University in Indiana, and a lot of, yay.
Hoosiers.
No, not really. A lot of my friends there have been to Holden, and it just sounded so wonderful that I had to apply, and I was lucky enough to be invited to come up. I think further back, another reason that I'm at Holden is because that I spent 12 years of my life in the convent as a Roman Catholic sister. I left that. I went there immediately after high school, and I stayed from 18 until I was 30, which is, you know, your basic formative years, I think. And then I left at 30, and I'm 44 now. On the 30th of July just passed, it was 14 years since I left the community. But I guess, as my mother says, you can take the girl out of the convent, but you can't take the convent out of the girl. And there is a real sense in which, in the 14 years that I've been away from the convent, I've been trying to get back to some of the things for which I went there in the first place. And I think that trying to, I know that being among people like yourselves who take God, the Word of God, and your response to it very seriously is a way that I can be helped in understanding some of these things again. I quit praying for a long time after I left the convent, because in the convent you had to pray when everybody said you had to pray, and you had to say the words that were ordained and all of that. And I thought that when I left the community, I would be able to pray better, because I would be able to pray out of my own need and my own experience. But I think I was wrong. And I quit for a long time. And in the last few years, especially through meeting the people that I have met at Valpo, I've been drawn very much back to understanding my own spirituality, what that means, and trying to pray again. So if I'm here for you, you're here for me too. And right now I teach at Valparaiso. I have a sabbatical next year, which I plan to spend in the Seattle area on a very scary venture. I'm going to try to write poetry all year. I don't have to work. If I can live on half my salary, I don't have to get a job as a cocktail waitress. And I'm going to try to write poetry. I know it sounds like absolute heaven to you, huh, Doug? But it sounds a little scary to me, too. This afternoon I wrote a poem in my bed. It was about trying to scrub a cast iron pot. Maybe if we have enough, is there anybody else interested in getting together and talking about writing and sharing some of the writing? I'd love to see what you have to say about my cast iron pot.
I just have a comment. Thursday night, there's a group from OSLC, this church that is from Moffitt, Indiana, Our Savior's Church, that wrote a poem, so you're all welcome to listen to it. We're going to read it Thursday night.
I thought it might. I mean, they did call for talented, semi-talented, and crazy people, and I think poets qualify in the last category. I thought we might, if anybody was interested, maybe want to read some of the poems that we've written or brought or are in the process of doing. We could do some puzzle poems or something. Anyway, if anybody's interested after the session, I'd really like to see if we could get together. Is that enough?
Thank you.
Okay. I've brought some poems. The Pasture, Robert Frost's poem. Some from the Song of Songs. And one called Poems from the Book of Hours. And as every teacher does occasionally, I forgot to write down who wrote it, where it was from. I have no idea. I cannot find it again. So if anybody does know where this is from, please direct me to the poet once more. I'd like to read some more of him or her. Let me read you The Pasture. These are what I would call poems of invitation. The Pasture, I think, is a poem of pure and simple invitation, although it's a very complex poem once we get to talking about it. The Song of Songs is kind of what happens after you accept an invitation. It's hearing one, and then what happens after it. There's a lot more than simple invitation going on here. And in the poems for the Book of Hours one, I think that this is what happens when you seriously, this is a good thing kind of that happens when you seriously do hear and respond to an invitation. But let's just start with Frost. Frost chose this poem to put at the beginning. It's the very first poem in all of Robert Frost. His first volume was called A Boy's Will. And this is the poem that opens the volume, A Boy's Will. The Pasture. I'm going out to clean the pasture spring. I'll only stop to rake the leaves away and wait to watch the water clear, I may. I shan't be gone long. You come too? I'm going out to fetch the little calf that's standing by its mother. It's so young, it totters when she licks it with her tongue. I shan't be gone long. You come too. Does anybody doubt that that's a poem? Good. Emily Dickinson said she knew she was in the presence of poetry when the top of her head felt like it was coming off. Anybody have that physical response? Goosebumps. Well, that's a start. That's a good one. So what does make this a poem? I hoped you would say that. Yes.
It triggers your imagination.
It tickles your imagination?
Yeah, it triggers it.
It triggers it. I like tickles as well. Tickles and triggers both. Yeah. It tickles and triggers your imagination. What does it make you see?
I don't know. It just, with me, I saw the country, I saw spring, I saw an invitation. I wanted to go.
Did you? Good, yeah. Good. So you heard that invitation as well.
Yes, I did.
Good. What other images did anybody see? Poems do trigger visual images for us.
Pastoral scene.
Mm-hmm. What specifically in that scene?
Cows and calves. And
cows and calves.
Grazing.
Calves, all right. And grazing.
Grass.
And grass. And what else? Brooke. You saw the nice stuff.
Motherly love.
Motherly love. Oh, you saw motherly love, huh? Wow, that's impressive. I only saw a cow and a calf. Was there anything else that wasn't so nice? Anything else that you see in this poem? What's he going to go do? He's going to clean the pasture spring. Okay, it's got, what's the pasture spring got on it? Or probably. I don't know. I've never seen a pasture spring. Definitely got leaves on it. Okay.
I think it's nice if the author wanted to share it with someone.
All right. Okay. That's all right. So this is not a monologue. This is a conversation. Only we don't hear the other half of it. It's kind of like getting in on those biblical conversations. You know, there's a dialogue going on here. Somebody out there is being invited, and somebody, the speaker of the poem, is doing the inviting. Okay. Now, before we talk about who else is out there, how is the speaker trying to get the other person to come along? What's he doing?
It's not going to be long.
Okay, it won't be long. It won't be long. Right, let's hold on to that for a little bit, because that might give us some clues about the person to whom he's speaking. How else is he getting the person to come?
Invites.
All right. There's a doing. Okay, he's telling what he's going to do, okay, and he's actually making an invitation.
He's drawing pictures with his words.
Sure, he's drawing pictures with the words. He's not saying, come with me. He's saying, come with me because I'm going to clean the pasture spring and feed the little calf. Okay? Mm-hmm.
How do you know he isn't commanding?
That's a good question. And when I rang the bell to begin this session, I wondered whether it were an invitation or a, what else could it be? A command it could be. Would you read it for us?
It depends entirely on your voice.
Would you read it for us in the way
that... I'll read it differently than you. My first impression was it's just as you read it, an invitation. then I thought, well, you could look at it as a command.
Could you read it for us as a command? Now, I don't mean to embarrass you or put you on the spot, but I do think that that's one of the things to understand about poetry very much. Poetry is something that somebody might have said, okay? Mm-hmm. And everybody, if I say to you, hello, that means one thing. If I say, hello, means another. If I say, hello, yet again. So the voice of the poet, okay, is something that we have to overhear in this poem. I'm sorry, I'll have to ask your name again. Helen. Helen, I got it as soon as you said. Okay, Helen. If you heard this poet commanding somebody to come, who might this, let's just imagine that this is a farmer. Who might the farmer command?
A teenage son,
all right, lazy old bum sitting in the house, and the daddy says, look, I'm going out to clean the pasture spring. I only stop to rake the leaves away and wait to watch the water clear I may. I shan't be gone long. You come too. Let's hear it.
I shan't be gone long. Darn if I'll stay out there very long.
Okay.
It could be also a mother that has a small child and she doesn't trust it to be home alone.
All right.
So she says, well, you come too. You
okay.
Know, because
right.
She promises the cows.
Okay. And she promises the cows.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like that. I'm going out to fetch the little calf that's standing by the mother. It's so young, it totters when she licks it with her tongue. Okay, so that's a promise.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, what would urge the teenage boy to come in our other scenario? Is there anything that would make him want to come in this language?
Teenage boy.
I can see the little girl, the child wanting to come with the mother. But gee, if you come, I'll let you see the little calf that's standing by the mother.
The teenage boy might think that's a fairly easy chore and decide to go rather than do something else. I see what they can get into.
I think that, yes. Here.
We have a farm in West Virginia and we have a lot of springs, and it's always amazing when you clean the leaves away, the miracle of water just bubbling up from the ground. I mean, if anyone had curiosity, it's always kind of an exciting thing to find the spring and to rake the leaves away and see that, and then you have to wait till the dirt and the sticks settle down and then you see the clear water bubbling up again.
Now, there's a lady who knows what Robert Frost is talking about. I've never done this. The most I've ever done is scrape the leaves away from the drain in the gutter or something like that. But that's a real sense of what's there. You know, we don't know anything until we experience it. I've cribbed your whole lecture, John, absolutely. We don't know anything until we experience it. But that's part of what the poet's trying to get us to do, to experience along with him the pleasure of cleaning the spring. I think that parenthesis is a super important part of this poem. And wait to watch the water clear, I may. Why did he put that in parentheses?
It's personal choice.
All right, it's his own personal choice.
It's a thought. Mind.
Okay, and that's the function of parentheses in grammar, isn't it? Not only am I a Latinist, I'm also a grammarian. When you put things in parentheses, it means that's not really a part of what I'm actually saying to you, it's just something I thought up along the way. And I hear it in a whisper. I'm going out to clean the pasture spring. I'll only stop to rake the leaves away and wait to watch the water clear, if I may. I shan't be gone long. You come.
I think that he's talking to his wife.
I do too.
Because my husband, oftentimes he'll do some chore and he'll say, well, why don't you just come in the backyard with me? He likes just, not that I have to even help him, he just likes to be there.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there's a shared presence, mm-hmm. and I sense that that's what he's doing.
I also sense a recalcitrance on the part of the person who he's inviting.
Mm-hmm.
He's really working hard to get that person to come along with him. You know, I'm not going to be gone long. It won't take you long. I see this farm lady kind of with her sleeves pushed up and harried, and she's probably canning things that need to be gotten off the boil immediately. And here's her old husband saying, "Hey, I'm going to go clean the pasture spring. You come too. I won't be gone long." I don't know if we heard the other half of the conversation. I don't know what the response to this invitation might sound like in a poem. I'm not sure I have a whole lot of hope for it.
Could he be writing and asking each reader to come along and see these pictures and see where he's going? You know, he's talking to each one of us.
To each one of us, sure. To the dear reader, you come along too. I think that's a very good possibility because it's at the beginning of the book of poems. And in a sense, what Frost is inviting us to is to continue with him reading the poems that he has written, because they will be clearing the pasture spring, taking away the muck from our ordinary perceptions of the world, and letting us wait to watch the water clear. Okay, and to be aware of connections between child and mother, of the depth of motherly love, even if we only see it in cows and calves. You know, so a lot of invitation on that score as well. Well, I would suggest to you that Frost is not as simple as he looks on the surface. I mean, are there any three-syllable words in this poem? I don't think so. Away, pasture, totters, going, standing, those are the only two-syllable words in this poem. This language is so simple. So, if you'll give me a word, pellucid, almost. We think we can see through it, but there's a whole lot more going on down there than we can see on the surface. So in order to get to a text, we have to go through the text and come back to the text. I heard that one. So that's what this is about. How much time do we have?
It's
10 minutes?
13 minutes.
It's, okay, good. Then we have time to at least look at the book, at the poem. Poems from the Book of Hours. I apologize for the poor duplication. It's the only thing I could manage at the time. This is a poem in which the poet talks to God, having understood God's invitation to him in nature. He is trying to respond to that invitation and think about what its consequences are for him, for himself, for his community. And that's why I chose it, and that's why I hope you like it. The light shouts in your treetops, and the face of all things becomes radiant and vain. Only at dusk do they find you again. The twilight hour, the tenderness of space, lays on a thousand heads, a thousand hands, and strangeness grows devout where they have lain. With this gentlest of gestures you would hold the world, thus only and not otherwise. You leap from out its skies to capture earth and feel it underneath your mantle's folds. You have so mild a way of being. They who name you loudly when they come to pray forget your nearness. From your hands that tower above us mountainously, lo, there soars to give the law whereby our senses live, dark-browed, your wordless power. In all these things I cherish as a brother, still it is you I find. Seed-like you wait, basking serenely in the narrowest compass and greatly giving yourself in what is great. This is the marvel of the play of forces, that they so serve the things wherethrough they flow, growing in roots to dwindle in the tree trunks and in the crowns like resurrection show. Now the hour bows down. It touches me, throbs, metallic, lucid, and bold. My senses are trembling. I feel my own power on the plastic day I lay hold. Until I perceived it, no thing was complete, but waited, hushed, unfulfilled. My vision is ripe. To each glance, like a bride, comes softly the thing that was willed. There is nothing too small, but my tenderness paints it large on a background of gold, and I prize it, not knowing whose soul at the sight released may unfold. That's a pretty long one, and a little bit more complex on the surface than Robert Frost's. But the best way to get hold of a long poem like that is to ask yourself, what stands out in neon for you? What things did you see, feel, hear? What words came through to you more clearly? Anything that you could connect with, especially in this setting. I think it's a wonderful poem for this setting.
I like the sentence that stands out. You have so mild a way of being. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the things I've had just being here in the last few days. My calm, relaxed, mild mm-hmm. manner.
Mm-hmm.
I have the feeling throughout the whole poem that this person is being the creator through this creation and is feeling the love that came about.
Mm-hmm. Any specific things that you see?
No, I just envision even the whole of creation and all.
Mm-hmm.
Like the spirit, the tree.
Okay, now that's specific.
Look
how specific we're getting now. It starts off with all of creation, and then it gets down to this forest and these trees and these ferns and the smell of the earth at the base of those ferns. That's what's getting down to it, okay? William Carlos Williams says, there are no ideas but in things. So you can't really see motherly love. What you can see is a calf so young that it totters when she licks it with her tongue. And what you can't really see creation, but you can see resurrection in the crowns of the trees on the forest. Those kinds of things. That the poet lives by specifics. And I think that, for instance, if I said to you standing here, look, what would you see? What would you see? You'd see two windows. What would you see?
A picture.
Okay, what would you see?
I'm
going to
see one.
You see one window. All depends on your perspective, right? But if I said, look at that needle, how it goes just in balance with my voice, you would see something very specific, and you would understand it, you would know it, I would communicate it much more clearly than if I just said, look at all of that out there. That's another thing that I hope will come through in the ways we talk about poetry and prayer. And I guess, yeah, all right, there's a point to make a connection with prayer. Sometimes it's perfectly okay to say, oh, God. Sometimes God might appreciate a little bit more specific kind of request, or I absolutely know this, that he would appreciate a more specific kind of praise. A particular thanksgiving, a petition for somebody, some particular person. Maybe what we can do when we pray for other people is only remind God that he made that person. And that he's promised him something. So, look, remember this God. This is what he needs right now. Maybe that's all prayer is. And maybe that's enough. Anyway, so prayer, poetry, specifics. The closer you see something, the clearer you say something, the more you can understand it and feel about it. I think I've about had it. I have an invitation to make to you. I do believe that the only way that you really do know something, understand something, is by doing it, by trying to do it yourself. So I'd like to ask you if you would please think about some invitations and maybe try to write down some invitations. Okay, now what I mean by that, to be specific, let me ask you to think for a minute. What things have you had in your life lately, or people, or events, that have been invitations for you? Or to what things, people, events, would you like to give an invitation, to make an invitation? What has invited you? What would you like to invite?